For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So how are you liking all this Old Testament study? Not too bad, huh? Well, believe it or not, we saved the best till last. We're going to move out of the minor prophets tonight, take on the last of the major prophets, and take on the book of Daniel. I think you'll like this one. This book is awesome. You know, Daniel is sort of like the book of Revelations to the New Testament. Daniel's that way for the Old Testament. This is the first really apocalyptic book that we're given, a specific form of literature with visions and stuff. Very interesting, amazing predictions of the future. If you understand these symbols in Daniel, they kind of set the tone for the rest of the prophetic books that come up, and especially I don't think you could possibly understand the book of Revelations if you didn't study Daniel first, because it's just very clear that these same symbols are brought forward there. We'll be talking some about the book of Revelation. Predictive prophecy is a unique thing found in the ancient Old Testament and New Testament. Nothing else like it in other literature. I know there are some claims. I've looked into most of those. I'm not seeing anything there, but this stuff here, boy, very persuasive, very powerful. The book is written against a background of turmoil. We read in chapter 1, verse 1, that in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put the treasure in the house of his God. Well, this third year of Jehoiakim was 605 or 604 BC. You'll see both numbers because of a dating quirk through this period. But the Battle of Carchemish had just occurred, where the Neo-Babylonian Empire is really dated from this time as far as its ascendancy. The Egyptians were defeated. The Assyrians had now been laid to rest as well. And so Nebuchadnezzar became the kind of supreme emperor of that whole section of the world at this time. He marched in there. Apparently there wasn't a big battle at Jerusalem on this occasion. You know, when a huge army like this surrounded your city, it's kind of like, all right, you can surrender the city to us, or you can take whatever we dish out instead. And so sometimes people would decide, all right, we'll surrender the city, because the alternative was going to be bloody as anything. And so they came in and took the city, and they partially looted it. We read how they took these articles of gold from the temple. And so, you know, these were the sacred furniture that had been built back in the time of Moses. Like the Ark of the Covenant, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Well, this is the guy that lost it. All right, he took the Ark. He basically took the stuff that was gold, which was like the Ark, solid gold top on that thing. He took these back to his own capital and put them in a temple to one of his gods. A supreme act of blasphemy. So this was a very dire and awful period. Now, just to scope ahead in history a little bit further, this part doesn't really come up in Daniel. Again, in 597, and then again in 587 or 88, remember the years go down in BC instead of up, there were uprisings in Israel where they were like, all right, the Babylonians were gone, we're back in charge now, and then he would send back another army and subjugate them, and those got really military and really brutal. Each time, groups of Jews were deported and taken back to Babylonia. And the last time, they had to do a siege of Jerusalem, breached the wall, and swept the city away, destroyed the temple absolutely, tore down the wall so no one could defend that site again. And by this time, few Jews were left in Israel. There were still Jews there. And Nebuchadnezzar purposely left some of the poorest Jews there to farm the land so they could pay taxes. But that was it. And so Israel, now the northern nation has already been destroyed by Assyria, and now the Babylonians come and subjugate the southern part, Judah. Israel as a nation ceases to exist at this time. These Babylonian conquerors were ruthless, they were brutal, they would kill for any reason, no regard for human life whatsoever. And so there was massive slaughter and slavery as a result. Really, all of the exiles that were taken to Babylonia served there as slaves. Now, in addition, you have to think about this from their perspective, which, you know, includes a perspective in warfare that is different than modern people. You've probably seen like movies like Spartacus, where the Romans would go marching into battle with these like flags or standards with eagles on them and stuff, and they would carry those right into battle with them. Those are their gods. And if you didn't carry your god into battle with you, you would set up an altar right behind the battle, because their belief was that the key to victory in military warfare was that your god would overcome the other guy's god. And so, in losing the way the Jews lost to Nebuchadnezzar here, basically when you get defeated like this, it doesn't just mean that your army is weak, it also means that your God is weak. And it has terrific theological connotations to them. And to have him take the most sacred objects used in the worship of God and put them in an idol temple was just an absolute tweaking of the nose of God. And so people were really depressed, I'm sure, and spiritually depressed at this time. There were a group of guys, young people, who he took in the first shift. They took collected young men, it says, mainly from the upper and middle upper classes, and marched them back as prisoners to Babylon. And in this first group to be deported was our author, Daniel, and his buddies. They're marched back hundreds of miles from Jerusalem to Babylon as prisoners in chains. Can you imagine what this must have seemed like as you plodded through the hot sun day after day out there on your way to God knows what? You'd really be thinking to yourself, where is God? We prayed to him. We looked to him for our safety. Now what? Where is he? Then they walk into this city, the city of Babylon, widely recognized as one of the seven ancient wonders of the world. This city was awesome. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, spectacular city, and excavations in modern times have confirmed ancient reports that we have from Herodotus and others that this city was just dazzling. And these guys from Jerusalem, a city that would have been a tenth that size, just a town really, walking into this massive empire with its awesome architecture and huge numbers of people must have just been awestruck. You know, it's like, oh my man, I've never seen anything like this before. And so it's just like, you know, our little thing back there is just such a, you know, parochial, minuscule country. And look at these guys, they're ruling the world. Look at this city. It must have seemed like this Babylonian Empire is like nobody's ever going to beat these guys. They're totally supreme. And so this brings up the issue of empire, which is a big theme in the book of Daniel. To rule an empire, to be not just a king, but to be the king of kings, to rule the world, is like the ultimate dream of human autonomy and self-rule and ego. I mean, it's like you can't really get any more successful than this, ruling the world. And so it's, you know, a dream that has captivated powerful leaders from ancient times right up to modern times. We think of Genghis Khan. We think of the Romans. We think of Bonaparte. We think of Hitler. They were all after this dream of world conquest and domination. No one ever seems to get it for very long. And most of these empires are also set up in defiance of God, who should be the King of Kings, who should be the ruler of the earth. It's in this setting, then, that Daniel gets a series of visions. And these dreams and visions that he has, most of which are also interpreted right for us right in the text, basically run along a central theme, a plumb line, which is could be summarized that God has everything under control. You know, it may seem like man has overthrown God's kingdom, and the great empires of man will rise like waves of the sea, rising up and falling back on the shore, but that in the end it's going to be Christ who establishes his eternal kingdom, and that will be the only worldwide kingdom that will ever work out. In fact, this very awesome Neo-Babylonian empire that Daniel had been captured by, within his own lifetime, was completely erased from the map and disappeared. Who would have predicted that? Well, God does. He told Daniel, don't worry, these guys are on their way out already. The interesting thing is that this assertion that God's Messiah, the promised one, is going to set up his worldwide kingdom is not just asserted in this book, but actually proven. And if you will take the next few weeks, a few hours out of your life to dare to read this book of Daniel, I think a few weeks from now, you'll be sitting there thinking to yourself, I had no idea that there was this much verification for what they said. No idea. This is material that for some reason is just usually not talked about. A lot of people find it too difficult, but it is awesome. As we think about this then, we live, you know, in our own modern world. In some ways there's certain similarities I think we could draw. A lot of things are out of control in our world. You know, we think about the spiraling, mushrooming population on Earth. It's a real quandary. You know, nobody's really given an answer to how, if we're having problems at 6 billion or even 7 billion, how we're going to cope at 10 billion. No one's ever done that before. No one knows what that's like, but it's ominous. It's worrying. There are a whole constellation of ecological disasters that are descending on the human race right now, many of them of our own making. The danger of warfare has never been greater. As the nuclear club expands year by year, with one after the other, countries gaining nuclear weapons, and the countries gaining them right now, some of the most malevolent and dangerous countries you could ever want to see with those kind of weapons, and you know, people who will use it, who couldn't care less if millions of people die. And it's scary. We think about international terrorism today and the way that it's able to just gridlock entire vast economies and no solution in sight, no diminution in sight whatsoever. We've got a lot of problems in our world. You know, it's easy to wonder, still today, does God really have everything under control? Or are we spinning completely out of control here? Also in our day, as back then, the people of God in full retreat. I thought the church was weak when I was a student. Well, it's much weaker today than it was then. And I documented for you last week how the church in the West is just in free fall. You know, at least in our culture. Fortunately, there are many countries around the world where, in the developing world, where Christianity is surging like never before. But in our part of the world, it just seems like the people of God have never had less say. They've never had more disrespect. It almost gets to the point today where Christians are being viewed as this strange and dangerous right-wing group like militia, the militia groups or something like that. It's almost, in many circles, almost feels awkward to admit that you're a Christian. The disrespect can be that intense. And so in those ways, I think that we're in an analogous situation, not as bad as theirs, obviously. Let's read the story and get introduced to our author. They took these prisoners to Babylon, and king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed and quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. Jeremiah refers to the captives being marched away to Babylon buck naked. And we don't know whether that happened to all of them or some of them, but there's a good chance these guys not only are marched there in chains, but naked to boot, just for the added humiliation. It was kind of, you know, considered a way to break the will and to condition people into a life of servitude and servility. They take them there, and he's given the job to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. Well, the Babylonian language and literature, so they're only learning to speak Babylonian, but the literature, basically they go to school there. These are students. And what we have to realize is this literature is all religious. They didn't have any secular fields of study back then. This was an intensely religious culture. Everything was viewed as religion. So they would have studied star constellations and stuff, but also the magical power of stars that have to be analyzed and studied. So they're really studying the, you know, Babylon is the seat of many of the arts involved in the occult. They're going to be studying spellcasting 203, astrology 798, and history of Baal 229. So these are the kind of courses they're taking. It's not anything like our math and geography and stuff like that. Now, why did they take hostages? This first group appears to be a smaller group of select boys who are hostages. This is a practice in ancient warfare, very common. We see this all the time. These boys would be young, probably 12 to 15 years old when they were captured. There's a good chance that Daniel may have been no older than 12 years. Can you imagine that? So they're old enough to be fluent in Hebrew and to know Jewish culture, but young enough to still be malleable. And their plan is to take these guys over to Babylon and turn them into Babylonians. We read in verse 5, the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and the wine which he drank. So this is the choicest food and wine that they're drinking and eating, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. So there's a little silver lining in Daniel's cloud. He's been taken away from his family. I'm sure he was just wept often, terribly sad about this. And yet, as he gets here, you know, there is a future for you. Sometimes they would be sent back as viceroys. The reason they would take these hostages and train them was because if they needed to put a ruler in place in Israel, these would be ideal, because their hearts had been won over and they were Babylonian at heart, but they were still fluent in the language and culture of the Jews. And so they would be the perfect ruler to put over them. At other times, they would serve sort of like ambassadors in the court and be translators so that he could administrate, and he needed translators to do that for him. But, you know, living as the king's personal servant would really be put them at the zenith of Babylonian culture. I mean, these guys would be way ahead of a Babylonian bricklayer or soldier or something like that. These guys basically would, you know, in the ancient world, royalty and getting associated with the nobility, those people were fabulously rich. Everyone else was poor. And so great power wealth and prestige was that lay ahead for these boys. Among these that came were some from Judah, namely Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are Daniel's buddies. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. And so, giving them new names, the beginning of the indoctrination process, where they're going to basically break them of their Hebrew identity and turn them into having a Babylonian identity, is that they're going to discard these Hebrew religious names that they have. You know, names were much more important in the ancient world than they are today. They meant something. And that said something about who you were, your name. People wouldn't tell their personal names to people, to strangers, because they felt that worried that they would use it to place curses on them and stuff like that. Naming someone was a mark of having an authority over someone. But they placed great care and took a real interest in what names people were given. Daniel, for instance, means God judges. The L at the end of his name is short for Elohim, for God. And he changed his name to Belshazzar, which means Baal protects his life. Now Hananiah, his name means Jehovah is gracious. There's the Yah at the end of his name, which is short for Yahweh, or Jehovah. They changed his name to Shadrach, command of Aku, another one of their deities. Mishael's name means who is what God is. And they're like, that's nice. We'll just flip that a little bit. Who is what Aku is? Yeah. And Azariah, his name means the Lord helps. There's that Yah again. And they changed his name to Abednego, which means servant of Nebu, another one of their deities. And so each of them is being stripped of their Hebrew identity and given their new polytheistic Babylonian identity. So these then youths, for the next 3 years, are just going to be immersed in the occult, which really, although a lot of people don't realize it, implicates you with evil spirits. They're going to be pounded daily, every day, by false teaching. And, you know, at that age, it's not that easy to have a critical faculty and to really raise questions about what you're being taught. You see this with your kids when they come home with all these new doctrines and beliefs that they're being taught at school. They're going to be given these new names. They're outnumbered. I mean, they're a tiniest minority. They have no other options, okay? There are no other options for them. They're living as exiles and strangers in a foreign land. Always a difficult proposition. Their language knowledge of Babylon has to go from 0 to 100 during this period, but during a lot of this period, they're not even going to be able to communicate with people. And so it's a very tough trial that lies ahead of them. On the one hand, then, they're given the carrot. Okay, you get through this and succeed here, you can have basically whatever you want. You know, we're feeding you already the choicest food right from the king's table, vintage wine. You'll still have that. Power, sex. You know, if one of these guys, when he graduates, if he wants a woman, he just claps his hands, and that's all there is to that. There will be supreme power, ability to do anything they want, money, fame, all the things that people like in life. Okay, you can have all those anytime you want them. All you have to do is comply. All right, we got a little program for you here. And just go along with it, and we're going to hand you the world for that. Of course, on the other hand, from the carrot is the stick. You know, you look ahead to chapter 2, verse 5, where Nebuchadnezzar was angry with some of his wizards. And he's like, I'll tell you what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to have your body pulled into 4 chunks by wild horses. Then I'm going to burn your house to the ground with your people in it and flip your chunks up on there. Nice guy. This is not the kind of guy you want to mess with. You know, Nebuchadnezzar is a fierce, brutal, dangerous ancient emperor who will kill, torture. They're committed to torture. There's a lot of menace here. If they resist this program, they know that death, painful, and certain is waiting for them. Very dangerous. And so it's a real difficult system, a situation. You talk about pressure to comply. Boy, this has it all over the place. Well, we read then as we go on in the story that Daniel takes this initiative. In verse 8, Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Why would he consider eating the king's food and wine to be defiling? Because in ancient practice, they felt that there was good reason to always, if you were going to like eat some meat, if you were slaughtering a cow or whatever, the first thing to do was to take it in and dedicate it in the temple to your gods. By doing this, this bestowed health-giving power into the food itself. The same with wine. They would offer drink offering with part of the wine and then serve the rest of it. So it was all dedicated to one of their idols. And so this food is what they're serving the guys. Daniel doesn't want to eat it, doesn't want to be defiled by eating this food. Now we read in verse 9 that God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So he's already at work. God is winning the heart. This leader of the school likes these kids. And so the official told Daniel, well, I'm afraid of the Lord, you're my king, who's assigned me your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. So he's like, I got a job to do here. I can't just be letting people eat whatever they want. Well, of course, too, as a Babylonian, he thinks that if you don't eat this food, then, you know, you're going to wither and you won't be as healthy because, you know, we have basically blessed this food and it's got magical divine power. And that's why the other kids would be doing better than you guys if we let you eat your own stuff. Well, Daniel says, all right, just test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Vegetables, I mean, probably including grains, right? Lentils, whatever, you can get protein. It's not just green vegetables, thank God. And water. So he's going on a vegetarian diet. Then compare our appearance to that of the young men who eat the royal food. And then you can treat your servants in accordance with what you see. You notice that even there he doesn't say, and then if it doesn't work, we'll eat the other stuff. He just says, then you can treat us however. He has already made up his mind. He's not going to eat this food. And he's making a statement here. If you understand what's going on, their way of thinking, these guys are basically making a subtle but clear statement that, you know, you guys think that's what makes people healthy. You're sacred food. We didn't take any of that stuff, and we're better off than you guys. That's what he wants to say to them. Well, Ashpenaz agrees to this because it's only 10 days out of the 3-year program. It's probably not going to do any harm. So he's like, all right, we'll give it a 10-day trial. And then at the end of the 10 days, they had some sort of examination or maybe athletic contest, who knows what, but they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. And so for the rest of the 3 years, here are these four sitting there eating their vegetarian stuff, and the rest are all eating the other. So, like I say, this is really a simple living apologetic that Daniel's giving here. He's giving a demonstration of something. And it's really that he's stripping the superstition and false belief in polytheism away and showing that none of those things really matter. And really, that what matters is that you're in touch with the true God. Of course, to carry this message, him and his guys have to stay ahead of the other 50 guys in that school. And so there's quite a bit of pressure on them to come through. You know, it's an amazing stand to be taken by a kid that age under those circumstances. Can you believe that somebody would do something like this? I mean, he was taking a huge chance here. And it worked out. But then as we go on through the story of Daniel, we see that he turned into this awesome guy. As someone that God would send messages directly to him and stuff. He became extremely prominent in the Babylonian Empire and later, again, in the Persian Empire. And wrote this book, which has affected millions in years since. It's easy to wonder, you know, why does God get some guys like this and really deal directly with them? And it just seems like Daniel's more spiritual than I am. I get that sense. I don't think I would have done something like this. I think his spirituality has a lot to do with decisions like this one made early in his life. And so it's possible, I think, to analyze what this decision is that he made. This was an initiative. They came up with this on their own. Nobody told them to do it. And firsthand, it was a decision to be different from everyone else. Here they were going to be the only ones sitting there eating their own vegetarian food. You know what it's like in school, where everybody's like, what a joke. What a losers, man. What's wrong with you guys? You know, they would be taking flack for this every day. And, you know, that's rough for a lot of us right there. A lot of us lose it right at that point. We like the feeling that we're just like everyone else. And we're kind of like sheep in that sense. You know, sheep like to herd together. And if you like the sense of being like a sheep with the sheep all around you and that feeling you get that I couldn't be that far wrong, look, everyone else does the same thing I do. If you depend on the wiggling tail in front of you as an assurance that I'm in there, then you're going to have trouble following God. Because God calls on us to break away from the conventional wisdom of mankind. And to follow him, and that's going to be a non-conformist path right there. Conformity and true spirituality are fundamentally incompatible, according to the Bible. This decision was certainly a decision to sacrifice. Can you imagine giving up? I mean, I like steak. T-bone, medium rare, yeah. And instead of that, we're going to get vegetables. And what about the vintage wine? This was the king's best wine that they got to drink. That wouldn't be too bad either. And they gave that up for water. Man, and at that age, giving up your wine for water, I don't know. This would not have been an easy move. I mean, only deeply held convictions could have led them to do something like this. This is really, truly an uncommon position they took. Frankly, if you follow the story out, what it is that they're already planning not just to make a protest statement here, but they're planning to win over the Babylonians to the true God. That's what he's doing. And by making this kind of demonstration that God's power is sufficient to cause us to excel above the rest of you, even though we don't eat any of your quality food or wine, he was laying a groundwork for that. Your belief system is false. He's got to break that news to them. It certainly is a decision to risk something for God. In this case, they're risking everything. And that is something God looks for in people that he wants to use greatly. People who aren't afraid to take a risk for him. Who aren't afraid to risk some embarrassment. Aren't afraid to risk some loss. Who don't always have to play it safe and keep a nice buffer of safety around us in a comfort zone. God calls us out of that. And it's really a decision to be faithful to God, because even at the end, you know, they were taking a chance that God would honor this stand they took. And they hoped that he would. But even if he didn't, they would have done it anyway. This was also a decision to disobey human authority. Now, that comes upon us. You know, we will be told by authority figures in our day to value certain things, to take certain positions that contradict God's way. And if you're a faithful follower of God, like Daniel was, then you'll make the decision to disobey that authority figure. I've seen kids who had to disobey their own parents who were insisting that they disown Christ and have nothing more to do with him. People are in jail right now today in a number of countries around the world because they refused to give up their loyalty to Christ when their government demanded it. At the same time, it was a decision to be respectful. Isn't it interesting? He is going to disobey their directive to eat this meat and drink the wine, but he does it in such a respectful way with Ashpenaz. Well, you know, why don't you give us a test and stuff? He comes up with a creative alternative. He's not coming in with a chip on his shoulder just saying, you can take your crap and shove it. You know, there's nothing like that in his demeanor. He's humble, and, you know, it's trying to work with him, and yet there's an underlying determination there. It's also a decision to ignore the apparent lack of blessing in their lives. Oh, man, is this important right here. Think about it. Here we are in Babylon. My family is back in Israel, if they're still alive. I don't even know if they're alive. And, you know, I'm being offered some opportunities here to get ahead, to try to salvage my ruined life, pulled away from my friends and family, marched out here humiliated, degraded, praying to God the whole time. When did he ever answer? Why, you know, why should I be faithful to God when he's not being faithful to me? In fact, what sign is there that God even exists? It looks like he's been completely powerless to do anything in the face of this Babylonian business. And now I'm supposed to refuse to eat quality meat and good wine just for some statement? Yeah, I think a lot of us would probably fail this test, actually. To outward appearance, nothing was going good in Daniel's life right now. And it would be easy to get pretty bitter about that. Yes, it would. It would be easy to reflect blame back on God because of that. But the nature of this decision they made was they were going to basically look away from the negative circumstances they were in. That doesn't reflect reality. That's temporary. We know where we're headed. We know who we're in with is God, and we're going to be faithful to him anyway. It's awesome. The story goes on. So to these four men, then, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel also could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. And so this all kinds of literature and learning was the Babylonian literature and learning, right? So these guys, even though this literature was godless, was in fact anti-God in the sense that it taught diametrically opposing views to everything that God argues in the scriptures, Daniel and his guys became scholars in that literature. Now, why would you sit around and study godless literature? Well, we'll see why he did it. It was very important, in fact. This was an important part of his testimony. And he was also gifted charismatically with this interpretation of dreams thing. A spiritual gift there. At the end of the time, set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked to them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. Well, you know, it's one thing when a person who's completely unlearned, who really has never even studied the other side, who's never been outside of the holler down in the hills, says, you know, I'm faithful to Jesus. Yeah, it's good. But it's a whole different thing when a leading scholar, somebody who thoroughly understands not just what I'm saying, but what you're saying may be better than you do. And that person, articulate, sharp, obviously a winner, a person who could make it in any field they chose, who have made it, are saying, I think that the Creator God is real I think the way of life prescribed by God is the true way. I believe in Jesus. That is a whole different matter. Man, I remember when I was in college, I used to think that Christians were pretty ignorant as a rule. Most of the Christians I'd run into, just they would make these statements about the godless and the wicked, but they often had never read any, you know, they didn't know what existential philosophy was. They hadn't read any of that. They were out of touch with contemporary culture. You know, I remember going to one lecture by a Christian guy, and he was lecturing how godless and wicked this book was that had come out at the time, and how nobody should read this book. And they asked him if he had read, you know, had he read it, and he said, "No, of course not." He's just like, "Well, oh my God, that is so lame. I can't believe we're listening to this guy. He's here critiquing a piece that he hasn't even read. How stupid can you get?" And I kind of, I felt a little, you know, embarrassed at times by Christians because of stuff like that. But then I went, somebody told me to check out these guys from Switzerland, from this outfit called the Brie. And, you know, it was Francis Schaeffer and Oz Guinness and Udo Mittelman and a group put on this conference, and I went there. They were talking about all of the most advanced reading I had ever done. They knew that much more besides these guys. You could just feel the depth of knowledge and understanding coming from them. They were conversant with everything from the newest song lyrics to the cinema and piercing analysis and stuff like that. And they were deeply committed to Jesus Christ. And I just sat there and I was just like, oh man, I've never seen anything like this. These guys are like scholars. These guys know more than some of my professors do. And they're Christians. And I just thought, man, that is awesome. I was very profoundly affected by that. I was like, you know, I want to be like them. I'd like to be able to take a stand for Christ, and not because I don't understand anything else, but because I have thought through these things. And I do have my reasons. And so how different it is with Daniel and these guys. They were at the head of the class, and they made sure that they were the best in that group. And this should be a template for us. We ought to think about this. We should be the best person in our place of work. We should be the most advanced. We have to get out in front of people thought-wise and do the reading so that we're not always catching up from behind. Well, in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And so these guys realized they couldn't come loping in behind everyone else, or even in the middle of the pack. The stand they were taking required that they come in at the front of the pack, and that's what they did. And so they wound up having quite a testimony in that area. Today, you know, we're in a situation, again, somewhat analogous, certainly nowhere near as bad as what they faced, but we too are in a system that's all-encompassing, and there's a lot of pressure to be indoctrinated by a cultural view and values that directly contradict God. Foremost among those, get the money. That's kind of that's the American bottom line. It's like, you know, okay, you can take your pick of professions or whatever. You can select your own school if it's not too bad, as long as it's one of the better ones. You know, you can marry whoever you want or whatever, but just make sure you get the money. All right? You need to come out with something that's going to really pay. And that's just considered axiomatic in our culture. Increasingly today, also to get diffuse sex. You have the right, you know, to sexual experience that's gratifying to you. You can get married, that's fine, but you know, if that marriage isn't delivering, you have the right to walk out of that and go and find something more gratifying. To get prestige. And of course, the money and the prestige kind of go together, but you know, you can't be a nobody. You have to make yourself a somebody And that basically is done through materialism. To get stoned or to, you know, feel pleasure pretty much all the time. And yes, if that involves being stoned, drunk, or what have you, whatever. And definitely to deny all objective truth. That is such a consensus. I've never seen anything like it in my life up until the past few years. We can go down here on campus and talk to 50 different people and pose to them the question, what do you think is absolute or objective truth? Truth that doesn't depend on the individual, that's really out there. And we get 49 out of 50 of those coming back with the same answer, and even with the same language, the same vocabulary. And it's going to be, well, I don't think there is anything as such as absolute truth. I think people that believe in absolute truth are dangerous and arrogant. And whatever truth is, you know, it's truth for me, and no one else can assess it, and you're going to have a different truth for you. And if there was an objective truth, how would we ever know it? That question, too. And we would hear those same comments from just about everyone we talk to. Now, it's interesting. You know, 20 years ago, you would have gotten totally different answers on that. There's been a huge cultural shift here. What do you think? Did 50,000 students at Ohio State each do independent research in the field of epistemology and realize that when you come right down to it, there really can't be a knowable objective truth? I doubt it. It's just a wiggling tail in front. It's conformity. That's all it is. And this pressure, this kind of unspoken pressure to accept your indoctrination as a good little, you know, postmodern student is pervasive. And it's, frankly, difficult to resist. As Christian believers, though, we have to decide that we're going to be different and that we're going to break from the flock. That security you get from just flowing along with everyone else's value system, that will carry you directly away from God's value system. God's saying not that way, the other way, over here. And for those of us that have met God, that becomes very important. In fact, God rises up and looks at every one of these and says, you know, none of these even reflect reality at all. A life lived in this direction is a life doomed to failure, to unhappiness, lack of good relationship, and ultimately spiritual death. So how useful are any of these things when you look at it that way? If we can believe what God says, our world's pressured way to go is the wrong way to go. And so we have a decision as we sit here tonight, thinking about this whole prospect of people being indoctrinated by their culture to view things a certain way, and whether they should take an independent line and maybe start thinking a different direction. Who is right here? Is our culture right in what they're saying? Or is God right? Is He speaking to us in the scriptures of the Old Testament and the New? And can that be believed? It's a real good question. And this question, along with it too, how would you ever know who was right? Isn't it just a matter of preference? Isn't it just how I feel? And, you know, I just follow my inner sense of what's right. Are you suggesting that there's actually a way to know truth outside of myself that I'm not making up? I am. I suggest this. Check out the book of Daniel for answers to these questions. Okay? God is pretty concerned for humans. We saw that last week when we studied Jonah. God cares about human beings. And He's gone to a great deal of work to set something down for us in writing that is actually self-validating. Now that may sound pretty impossible, but it's an ingenious way that God has set up His words so that we can know that this comes from Him. that this could not have come from human beings. And to anybody willing just to take the time to learn it, to study it, well, it'll blow your mind. It will absolutely blow your mind. I think that as little as 4 weeks from now, if you join us in this study, you could be sitting here just astonished and realizing, so this must really come from God. There's no other explanation I can give. Even if you don't reach that conclusion, and you sit here 4 weeks from now saying to yourself, well, it was kind of interesting, but no, I'm not convinced. I don't think it was that good. At least you'll know that you had the integrity to hear out what God's message is to you. And I think you can feel better just for that alone. And so that's the challenge I'm going to leave you with tonight on our introduction to the book of Daniel. All right? Next week, then, we'll start studying these remarkable visions that scope right down through history up to our present day and beyond, and tell us what is yet to come in our day as well. All right. Who's got a thought or a question? Right over here is one.
Maybe you can answer this question. When you were portraying these guys as walking to Babylon and thinking, where is God? Our God has been defeated. I thought he was in control. Would they have had any teachings from prophets who had been saying, Babylon is going to come and take you away, but I am in control? Would they have had any of that kind of teaching at least tucked away? Because weren't there prophets that did prophesy about this?
Yes, there were. Isaiah prophesies extensively about it, 150 to 200 years before the time of Daniel. About 150, I'd say. And then it's also clear later in the book that Daniel is familiar with Jeremiah, a guy who was older than him, but they were both alive at the same time. I'm not sure when he became familiar, but he, at least later, he knew about Jeremiah and his prophecies. So that was probably helping them.
Because that brings me comfort, because they at least had some of God's message. That I'm guessing, I guess I'm speculating, but we do too. And when our culture presses down around us, I'm really grateful that I've got God's message on paper that I can go and critique and think through and, you know, weigh against what I'm hearing and stuff. So
great
point.
There's
a similarity there.
Great point. That's why God gives us his word, is so that, you know, when we get rocked by circumstances like this, we've got something objective to look back to. Particularly when it comes to prophecy, you know, God was pretty adamant through Isaiah, for instance, that I'm going to tell you what's going to happen beforehand, before it does. And that way you'll know that I'm God, and you can rely on the other things I say as well. So God uses prophecy exactly that way, and he'll still use it that way today. Okay?
I have a question about reading through the Old Testament, and you read through, and the timeline can really be confusing. Like, if you look at Daniel, and we just talked about 3 years, then the very next book, Daniel chapter 2, it says one night during the second year of his reign, and 3 years would have... I get very confused when I'm reading through and talking about timeline and trying to get things straight.
The best thing to do would be to get a good commentary that is also a critical commentary, such as one I like on this part is the Bible Knowledge Commentary, a one volume, really good, pretty good Old Testament simple commentary, or a commentary like on Daniel, John Walvoord's book, Daniel, Key to Bible Prophecy, is superb commentary on Daniel. And I think whenever reading extremely ancient texts like this, it's good to have a commentary, because they will explain every question like that that comes up. They really think through those things. Okay, about over here.
I have a friend that went into prison last Monday, and for several months before he went in, we got together pretty much on a weekly basis to study the Bible. He wanted me to teach him the Bible, and I decided that what I wanted to do was have him develop an excitement about reading the Bible, about, you know, a belief that the Bible is interesting, it's fun, it's challenging, it's got great drama, and it's about the most interesting book that you could possibly read. And And I guess that worked because the last time we got together, we went through the whole book of Revelation in one night, one sitting. And what you did tonight just reinforced for me what a fantastic read.
Thank yeah, you. No kidding. Once you get past a certain, it's a little hard at first, but once you get a certain level, a threshold of understanding, it gets really exciting and fun to read the Bible. Yeah. Okay, let's go over here.
I thought it was interesting, the list of things that you say we're indoctrined with, and at the bottom is the denial of objective truth. And then you show about Daniel and how he took a stand, and he had faith in the true God. And in Ephesians 6:10-20, there's another passage that says, take a stand, and your belief system is going to help you do that. And I think it's really important for us to think about what our belief system is, because we can't take a stand and be different if we don't know the true God.
Great point. Yes, I totally agree. You know, it's nice that we have Jesus in our lives, and it's nice that we can pick up our Bible and read a devotional passage or two, or maybe read a devotional book, to feel edified, to feel built up. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's not enough. I think we also have to develop our worldview in a somewhat sophisticated way, and that includes then reading critical material, that is, material that goes in depth into the problems in our worldview and other worldviews, and we have to wrestle through that to become the kind of communicators that God needs in this culture. People who really understand what it is we're talking about here. Yeah, I know, it's not like, you know, you get all intellectual when you try to talk to people and stuff like that, but it's not necessary. You can sense when somebody knows their stuff. You know, they've done the reading, and you can just sense that. You know, they don't have to flaunt it at all. And that's, I think, what I'm advocating. We need to move in that direction. Good point. Let's go one more back in the corner there.
I like what you said about your experience with the guys from LaBrie and how it made an impression that they knew, you know, not only what they were talking about, you know, with Christian stuff, but the arguments from the rest of the world. And I had the very same experience. I was kind of dabbling in Eastern thought around the time I was investigating Christ, and you know, I hadn't read extensively, but I'd certainly read a lot more than any of the people that were sharing Christ with me. And I was shown a chapter out of Oz Guinness's book, The Dust of Death, about Eastern thought and how it stacks up against the Bible. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, man, this guy's, you know, not only has he read everything I've read, he's read even more. Mm-hmm. And he was laying it out, he, you know, clearly understood it. And then he comes out and says, although there's, you know, a lot of stuff to be said, it's basically wrong. You know, and just came right out and said, you know, it doesn't cut it. And pretty much demolished the whole, you know, thought system. And that was a real major turning point for me, to see a guy who had studied it way more than me, then come out with a bold statement like that, and it really got me to start thinking seriously about Christ at that point.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are probably many people that come to Christ without ever seriously going through any intellectual struggle of any kind. Just take a chance on God, because they are in need, and there's nothing wrong with that. But then, I think, even if we come to the Lord that way, unless we strengthen our faith and build the foundation beneath what we believe, I think we walk in daily vulnerability to doubt and confusion when we get hit with these things that we have not really studied and prepared for. It rocks your faith. And so I think however you come to faith in Christ, whether it's through a process of struggling and reasoning through the whole thing, or whether it's a process that's maybe more emotionally motivated, still, developing the worldview of Christianity is crucial for all Christians for their spiritual health. Let's pray together. Lord, we thank you for this astonishing example that you give us in the person of Daniel here, somebody who is faithful to you, God, even in the face of such dreadful circumstances that he was in. And actually, right from day one, he not only is not focused on how unfortunate he's been, but he's already lining up to win people over to a knowledge of you. Lord, I would pray that we would really learn something from this and feel challenged by it. God, we can't afford to sit around and feel sorry for ourselves and bemoan, God, our circumstances. Teach us to be like Daniel, Lord, victorious in the face of that, faithful to you right down the line, and bold and courageous enough to take a stand, even if it's at personal risk. And also pray, Lord, I'm just so excited about going and reviewing these great prophetic visions of Daniel and how amazing it is to see you laying out the future course of history right there in pages in front of our eyes. Unbelievable. And every time I do it, my faith is just strengthened more. I pray that this study, God, will be revolutionary for many people here. And God, if we have friends we can think of that might want to come out and hear this, we pray that they'll come as well. In Christ's name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.